welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up later in the hour, we'll be talking about those wildfires devastating the western part of the country. But up front, earlier this summer, an alligator was found roaming a neighborhood in Lancaster County. That's right, an alligator. It was captured by East Cocalico Township Police and turned over to the Forgotten Friend Reptile Sanctuary in Manheim. The gator was probably someone's pet, got too big, and was released into the wild and found itself wandering in a residential neighborhood. It's becoming a bigger problem recently, and some are calling for banning the sale of alligators as pets. Joining us today is Jesse Rothacker, who is with Forgotten Friend Reptile Sanctuary in Manheim. Mr. Rothacker, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having us today.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, I should mention that Jesse Rothacker is here, but he is not alone. There is a 2-foot-long alligator right there. You're holding on to them tightly, I assume.
Yeah, and to be fair, I'd say probably closer to 32 inches.
Okay, all right, so he's closer to 3 feet right now. This is actually the alligator that was wandering in the neighborhood near Denver, correct?
Yeah, this is the one in Lancaster County, and there's been so many of these that you have to make the distinction because people are saying, is that the Lancaster County alligator? Is that the Clearfield County alligator? Is that the Chester County alligator? And then at which point I have to say, well, which Chester County alligator are you talking about? But this is the one that was from Lancaster County. A guy went to let his dog out, a guy named Dan Rogers, and when he let his dog out, lives in a normal residential neighborhood, finds an alligator.
And what did he do?
So Dan did what any bright man would do. He yelled for his wife.
And she didn't believe him from what I understood.
So he called Selma, and Selma says, whatever, Dan, I'm sure there's no alligator. She thought he's pulling his leg, and so she comes out, and sure enough, here's this alligator, the one that is sitting right here on the desk in front of you with dozens of sharp teeth, very powerful jaws, good muscle tone. And as you said, I am keeping an appropriate grip on him, staying out of his bite radius. So they end up calling the police for assistance, and the police, East Cocalico Township Police, it's not like they get alligator calls every day in northern Lancaster
County.
That's
a good thing. Yeah.
So it probably is good. So the police show up, and they said when they got there, they said, oh, wow, I thought this was going to be a mental health call. There really is an alligator.
So the police captured this alligator. Does this alligator have a name?
Well, I've affectionately named him Mr. Rogers after Dan Rogers,
okay.
The resident who found him.
And that's appropriate for being on public broadcasting station today.
Mm-hmm.
So they called you.
Right.
How long have you been doing this where you're providing sanctuary to reptiles?
Forgotten Friends started in 2004. So officially we've been doing it for going on 15 years. And this is just a normal routine for us, picking up an alligator on the way home from an outreach program. And that's where we were. We were finishing up an educational program where we bring out reptiles to camps and schools and churches and that stuff. And we were actually at a camp doing a program, and my phone would not stop ringing. So finally, we finish up our program, and I have two different police officers leaving me messages about what do we do with this alligator. So we stopped on the way home and literally bailed this alligator out of jail. They had him locked up. This kind of cracked me up. He was in lockup in the cell in East Cocalico Police.
He couldn't crawl between the bars?
Well, I think they actually had him in a smaller critter cage, which was inside the lockup, just to make sure that he wouldn't get out. And I don't know what an alligator would do loose in a police station.
Well, we kind of have been smiling about this, but this has become a real problem in Pennsylvania. How often are you getting alligator calls to come rescue or find an alligator that is wandering, I don't want to say in wild, but freely?
We get calls dozens of times a year. So probably about an alligator a week is what we get calls for. And what I want people to understand is as they're driving and listening, they might be thinking, oh, I remember that one time I heard about this. And for every one time you hear about this, you need to count 10 or 20 times that you're not hearing about this at least. Because out of all the alligators that we've been called for, there was only a couple of them that the media ever knew about, that the news, because every time we get an alligator, it doesn't always make the news. So Mr. Rogers here from Lancaster County, for some reason, his story really caught on, and there's been a lot of awareness about his case. But keep in mind, this is happening time after time after time after time after time. And it doesn't need to, because other states have regulations that say you cannot have pet alligators. In Pennsylvania, we know about it. Our legislators know about it. And it's just legislative laziness. They will not stop the sale of pet alligators here.
All right. I want to talk about that in just a moment. But how do these alligators become free that they're wandering around?
Oh, it's a really typical story. People with bad judgment will get these guys when they fit in the palm of your hands. And then it's just a ticking time bomb. It's a matter of time till they go from a 6-inch hatchling to an alligator, usually around 2 or 3 feet long, is the time when they release it. That's when they realize it's a handful, but it's on its way to 5 or 10 feet or bigger. In June, in Florida, there was a 12-foot alligator that ate a lady who was walking her dogs. So it's not likely that they would be a threat to people in Pennsylvania, but that is the same species that can grow 10, 12, potentially 14, 15 feet long. On the upper end, it is something that could eat your pets or potentially your neighbors.
Now, this one, as you said, about 32 inches, is not a big alligator as what many people would picture in Florida, what you would see. But could that alligator attack a dog or a small animal?
Oh, at this size, he would be eating food, say, the size of a rodent at this size. So your cats, your dogs, they would not be in trouble around a 3-foot alligator. When it turns into a 4 or 5-foot alligator, then it is a different story. I mean, even as we have these guys set up right now, we have a lot of big alligators that have come in recently. So we have them set up outdoors in our iguana house, and we had to move our iguanas indoors because if the iguanas get too close to these guys, you know, they're probably going to lose a portion of their tail.
So what do you feed him?
So we can actually feed him a mix of different things. Basically, anything on the Atkins diet is something that an alligator is going to like. They're carnivorous. So one of the easy things we feed him is just a Missouri crocodilian pellet. That's something that a lot of zoos are going to use because it's nutritionally balanced just for this species. But also we can feed him things like small rodents. So we'll give him frozen micicles out of the freezer. If we're making chicken for dinner, the alligators may get a little bit of chicken. If we're having venison, we may give him a couple bites of venison.
So from what I understand, someone can purchase an alligator as a pet pretty inexpensively, correct?
Right. And no background check, no training, no licensing. I mean, even your pet dog is supposed to be licensed, not your pet alligator, not in Pennsylvania.
So how much, I mean, I've seen reports that alligators can be purchased for $50 in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's not unusual. You'll see them at a sale for, you know, $50, maybe $75, $100, but right in that $50 to $100 range. And now compare that even with your pet dogs. I mean, you could drop $1,000 on a pet, you know, on a new puppy easily.
So where do people buy them?
So you can go online, as you can imagine, you can find anything online. And if, let's say you live in Maryland and you want to buy an alligator, you live in New York, you want to buy an alligator, it'll usually say on those online listings, we cannot ship them to those states. If you live in Pennsylvania, great, they can ship anything to Pennsylvania.
All right, so let's talk about that and the legislation. You just mentioned states surrounding Pennsylvania and alligators, the sale of alligators as pets is banned in New York, Maryland, what other states?
New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, Ohio, virtually all of our surrounding states, you cannot have pet alligators. And then if you get into the Southeast, then they're regulated as wildlife in the states where they're native. So figure everywhere from the Carolinas to Texas to Florida, then you can't have pet alligators because they're regulated as wildlife. But we're one of the only states that allows buying and selling, keeping of pet alligators.
Why?
Well, it's legislative laziness. That's the only term I can come up with. So to be fair to legislators, they are obviously very busy. But keep in mind, when we had some of the very sad stories out of Penn State with child safety, there were dozens and dozens of child safety bills that went through the legislature because it was an important public issue. But there's not enough awareness about the alligator problem to make it an important public issue. So I think if the public would realize this is actually a humane issue, that we're taking an animal that can't be kept, that's being kept inhumanely in these tiny cages, that's being treated wrong, and that's eventually being released in the wild to literally freeze to death in the winter. I think if enough people knew it was a humane issue and that Pennsylvania is not keeping up with surrounding states and just being proactive and treating our animals, with respect, then I think maybe our legislators would work on it.
We're going to talk more about that in just a moment. But first, let's take some phone calls. Otto is in Gettysburg. Otto, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
Very interesting topic. About 45 years ago, I was working at a nature center right outside of Washington, D.C., within about 2 miles of Washington, D.C. And wouldn't you know it, I got a call one day from the park police. They reported an alligator at Sligo Creek Parkway. And it was my duty, not theirs, to respond. So I grabbed a 55-gallon drum and something called a choke pole. You will know what that is.
Yeah, that's what the Denver police
used. There was no question about where the gator was because there was about 70 people standing around. You know, so I pulled up in my green truck and green uniform and approached this gator, who appeared to be sort of comatose. He was, by the way, he only had 3 legs. He was missing one of the front legs for some reason. And when I got a little too close to him, he got very uncomatose real fast. Boy, he could really move. I did manage to capture him and put him into that 55-gallon drum, and I put him in a cool spot and wondered what in the world's going to happen next. Well, wouldn't you know, they found the owner. This lady drove up, and I said, your gator has been sitting in that drum. He's probably not too happy. And she got him out of there, and off she went, drove away.
How long was that gator? How big was that gator?
Oh, he was well over 4 feet. He might have been 5 feet from nose to tail.
Well, that's quite a story. Hey, Otto, thank you very much for sharing that story. But in that case, the owner came back and, mm-hmm. and got it. Would that happen here in Pennsylvania where the police in, okay, say, for example, the East Cocalico Township Police, if the owner would have shown up and said, that's my alligator, would the police have said, no, you can't have this back? Or...
Right, and in most cases, the police would have no recourse if they did show up. So there would be a couple municipalities. Say you get into a bigger city like Lancaster, they would have some municipal regulations that say no alligators, no venomous snakes. And there's a few municipalities that will have regulations. But most municipalities, they're talking about how close your fence can be to the property line. They're not talking about pet alligators. So it's, and even in a place like Lancaster City, if there are municipal regulations, that doesn't really help when they're legal and easily purchased within the state. So we would recommend some things, like one proposal, one idea. There's a couple ways to come at this problem. But if you would make it difficult to buy an alligator, instead of having it be $50, well, let's make it $1,000. Let's at least make it closer to the cost of a puppy and have that $1,000 include some licensing, some registration, and some microchipping. Because all of the alligators that have been found, if the owner doesn't show up, no one knows where they came from. And so if part of the registration for owning an alligator, let's say it must be microchipped, let's say you go to Animal Hospital of Dauphin County is one of our local vets who works with exotics. We'll get them set up through Department of Agriculture to process microchips for alligators. And then if an alligator is loose in the Susquehanna or an alligator is loose in Italian Lake in Harrisburg, you can scan that puppy and you can see who it belongs to and who's responsible for releasing it.
That puppy was a figure of speech, right?
Yeah, sorry, that puppy. Yeah, that alligator, that reptile.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Jesse Rothacker, who is with Forgotten Friend Reptile Sanctuary. He goes out and rescues reptiles such as alligators that are in the wild, or in this case, the alligator he has with him today, one of the alligators, actually has three, a 32-inch alligator that was wandering through a neighborhood in Lancaster County earlier this summer. And talking about legislation to ban the sale of alligators as pets. Pennsylvania does not have a law. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we go back to the phone, I did want to follow up a little bit on the legislation. There has been legislation legislation proposed in the past in Pennsylvania that would ban the sale of alligators as pets. But it didn't go anywhere. What happened?
No, the last time, because remember, we've been beating this drum for many, many years. The last time anything went anywhere was in 2011. Senator Richard Alloway from Franklin County, who is still an active state senator, he's involved in a lot of animal and wildlife issues. He met with me along with a number of other legislators that I met with. And Senator Alloway, he offered to propose a bill. But in that meeting, what I told him is, look, you need to work on one species. You can't make a broad approach to this because otherwise people are not going to support it. You need to deal with this, write this regulation with a scalpel, not with a sledgehammer. So I said, please just do one bill for one species just for alligators because they really are a unique problem. And unfortunately, Senator Alloway and many senators, they have the opinion that we're just better off banning it all, banning everything. And when they start saying something like we're going to ban all exotics, they don't realize that language means, well, if you're banning all exotic pets, you're banning goldfish, you're banning hamsters. I mean, so they need to have the correct language. So what happened in 2011 was I had told him, please only regulate this one species. American alligators are the one major species that cannot be kept to adults as adults in Pennsylvania. And I said, if you're not going to do one species, please don't do anything at all. So he ends up putting out a bill for about 300 species, including alligators and a number of venomous snakes. And so that bill went nowhere. But what I would encourage is if there are legislators that are willing to take this approach, to actually regulate the one species, American alligators, it would be one species that cannot be kept until adults. You can talk about all those other species another day, but I would really like legislators to consider American alligators not being pets in this state.
As you said, legislators are very busy, and there probably are legislators who would look at this and say, you know, we don't want to waste our time on something like this. But you see it as an issue. I mean, when you have a 32-inch alligator wandering through a residential neighborhood, and it's happening more often where you're dozens of times being called out for alligators to capture alligators, that this is a public safety issue as well as a humanity issue, humanitarian issue, I should say, that, these animals probably very often end up dead in the wild when they've been released. So have you, since 2011, have you heard from any legislator who would be interested in talking about that?
No, I have not. And so legislators are very busy and they don't consider it a voter issue. But, you know, what I'd like to encourage people who look at these as something that's not worth their time is I'd like you to consider what are the causes that you advocate for. And typically, important causes that humanitarian people advocate for are for the weakest and the most vulnerable among us. Usually, they're looking for children. They're looking for economically less advantaged people. And these are things that we know it's right to help the weakest among us. And when I look at these reptiles, they are some of the weakest and some of the most vulnerable. They're the species that falls through the cracks. We care about the cute and cuddly and furry, but then we imagine these cold-blooded guys as being lesser than. And so what I'd like people to consider is that, you know, every animal is important. Every animal deserves the right life, deserves a little bit of concern. And even if this is not your idea of a favorite pet, these are still amazing animals. And it is a cruelty issue to take something that's going to be 10 or 12 feet and put it in a tank on your dresser. And if you had seen all the cases that we've seen over the last 15 years where we go to pick up these alligators and they have outgrown their tank for many, many years. Their water has not been changed for many, many months. And you see the conditions they're subjected to. It really is a humanitarian issue that I think we can stop and say, you know what? We have time to consider the weakest and the most vulnerable among us.
Why is he opening his mouth when he's looking at me?
I think he's smiling to be on Smart Talk this morning.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
So what happens when they are taken to your sanctuary? That's not their permanent home for the most part. What happens to them after that?
So we're able to keep these guys pretty safely, pretty comfortably, up to around 3 feet, 4 or 5 feet, much less comfortable. So we work with a couple rescues in Georgia and in Florida that will help us rehome these guys into a warmer climate. Now, when I say we rehome them, we can never release them into the wild again. Once they're in captivity, you're talking about an animal that looks at people and he goes, oh, that's where my meals come from, because they grow up without a fear of people. In fact, they learn that where people are around, that means the people are bringing them food. So if you take an animal, an alligator with no fear of people, that associates people and food, and you release them in the wild, as they start to grow, they turn into an 8 or 10 foot alligator. They associate people with food. That's a bad combination.
Let's take some phone calls. Steven is in Minersville. Steven, you're on the air.
Yes. My question is it possible that there hasn't been any legislation because there hasn't been a big enough tragedy involving alligators? And my other comment is just, see you later, alligator.
After a while, crocodile.
So the point he's making, though, is a very serious one and a good one, that often it takes a tragedy before anything is done in the legislature, or that people pay attention to it.
And that's why I wish we could be proactive on this issue, because he's correct about that. Typically, the way exotic animal regulations happen across the nation is you'll get nothing, nothing, nothing. No one will lift a finger. Then there will be an incident. And then instead of doing something responsible, you get a knee-jerk reaction. And they will have this overwhelming regulation where they kind of have that ban everything type of mentality. And all they've done at that point is driven this whole market underground. So instead of having a responsible regulation that says, look, we can do this in a proactive way, we can think about it. We have a Department of Agriculture that's already getting tons of licenses from all kinds of people, including reptile breeders, are regulated by Department of Agriculture. So we could take that bureaucracy we already have, we could make a license, we could do microchipping at some of the places. Right here in Harrisburg, Animal Hospital of Dauphin County has 3 different vets that work with reptiles. So they could do some microchipping, they could do a responsible solution, and then we would not have to wait for a tragedy. Because when the tragedy happens, that's when we tend to overreact, and then you're just driving the market into a black market underground, and it's not really effective.
Let's take another call from Daphne in Camp Hill. Daphne, you're on the air.
Good morning. Boy, was I shocked to hear we have alligators. I turned it on a little bit late. And did you say that the alligator ate the woman that was walking the dogs or the dog?
Well, it was actually a lady in Florida in June, and you could look that up, but there was a 12-foot alligator, and it was a tragic case. A lady was walking 2 of her dogs in Florida, and this is very rare. It doesn't occur often, but occasionally alligators can eat people, and in 2018 in Florida in June, that did happen again.
My comment is, you know, as a gardener, I have seen warming in my garden in the past 40 years. I see things blooming in the fall that only used to bloom in the spring. So, you know, if we get alligators here like that, and we're going to have swamps pretty soon, the way things are going with all the rain and all the global warming, we're going to have alligators living out in the wild that are being released like that.
Hey, thank you very much for your call, Daphne. The point she makes about a warming climate, I mean, how far north do gators live?
They only come into the Carolinas. So, you know, while I can understand people think along those lines, scientifically, they're not going to survive in Pennsylvania. So,
well, that's another question we have from a listener. Mary asks, can an alligator survive in creeks and rivers in Pennsylvania during the winter? Can they survive in streams and creeks?
No, they cannot. So they will, and that's one of the reasons we have legislative laziness, is legislators figure this is a problem that takes care of itself every winter when the release alligators freeze to death. And I would say that's not a solution. That's not humanitarian at all. That's animal cruelty.
Well, we have along those lines, Lynn says, a dog can go into a stream and not worry about getting tagged by an alligator. The guest is right on. This is really animal cruelty, what people are doing, releasing these animals into the wild.
Yes, it is. Mm.
So, you know, I'm curious about your background as far as the Forgotten Friend Reptile Sanctuary. Mannheim is not exactly the place I would think of as a home for or a sanctuary for reptiles. How'd you come to be?
Well, I was just a regular kid who loved reptiles, and you could probably imagine there's a lot of kids like that out there. If they see a snake or a lizard or a turtle, they don't back up. They want to get closer. They want to pick it up. They want to hold it and learn about it. So I was like that growing up, and I went from having one pet reptile to realizing there was actually a need, that there are a lot of unwanted reptiles that are given up. And so in 2004, I started a small organization just kind of as a hobby to find homes for pet reptiles. And then that expanded. Now with our educational outreach, we get to do hundreds of programs for schools and churches and camps and libraries. I believe we're at a library in Chester County tomorrow. I think we're at Milton Hershey School on Friday. So that's a little bit of what we get to do. And that's where most of our revenue comes from.
That was my next question. Where are your revenue comes
from? Right.
Yeah,
there's definitely no money in rescuing reptiles. So our rescue side, we lose money. But on our outreach side, we get paid to do programming.
So one thing I'd like to ask, and we're about to wrap up this segment of the program. I want to thank you, Jesse, very much for being with us. By the way, if you see, go to our website, WYTF.org, because you do have the skeletal skull of a large alligator. How big was that alligator when it was alive?
Well, I've heard you can count for about every inch of the snout is about 1 foot of length for the alligator. It's not an exact science, but it's somewhere around accurate. So right now you're looking at a snout that's over 12 inches. So my guess is that probably is somewhere between an 8 and maybe 10 foot alligator.
Well, the teeth on that skull is a lot bigger than the 3 footer that you're holding right now. So if this one would open his mouth, I think I'd probably take a step back or two. Final question: if unfortunately it seems as though we're still going to have people who will, get these animals, these alligators as pets, and probably release them once they do get too big and they can't take care of them, if someone comes across an alligator, what should they do?
Just call authorities. And remember, these guys, especially at the 2-3 foot size, they're more afraid of you than you are of them. They're not going to approach a person. If they're a 3 foot alligator, they might weigh 5 pounds, average person, say 100 or 200 pounds or more. So they're not going to approach you for a meal. They might be approaching something like, a mouse or a fish for a meal. So it's not a danger to you. But if you see one, just call authorities. Eventually, it might be like East Cocalico Police. They turned up and helped with it and called us, or we had police in Philadelphia last week that they called us when a resident found an alligator out near Philadelphia.
Jesse Rothacker with Forgotten Friends Reptile Sanctuary in Mannheim. Thank you very much, and thank you for, first of all, it's very educational, but I think it is something that provides a good public service for people to know, and also for humanitarians out there to realize that this probably is not the best pet in the world to have.
Yeah, thanks to everyone who's listening, who has concern, who's giving reptiles a chance and looking out for the weakest and most vulnerable among us that deserve protection. So feel free to ask your legislators to stop selling pet alligators in Pennsylvania.
Thank you very much for being with us. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk.
More than 60 large uncontained fires burning right now. This image showing a massive tornado-like swirl of flames from that deadly car fire tearing through Northern California. That fire alone has now scorched more than 100,000 acres.
And those are some of the headlines that you've heard often over the past couple weeks. 90 wildfires have burned, mostly in the western U.S. in 2018, claiming more than 1 million acres, thousands of structures, and killing several people, including at least 2 firefighters. More than 60 wildfires are burning right now in 15 states. It's being called the worst wildfire season in more than a decade. Hot, very dry, and windy weather is making it even worse. Thousands of firefighters are working desperately in many cases to extinguish the flames, including contingents from right here in Pennsylvania. And that's what we'll discuss over the next half hour. Joining us is Mike Kern, Pennsylvania's Chief Forest Fire Warden. Mr. Kern, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also joining us is Chad Northcraft. He's a forester in Hazleton. He just returned from fighting fires in Nevada. Mr. Northcraft, yes, Northcraft, that's correct, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Yep, good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk, WITF. WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Chad, I want to start with you because I'm sure a lot of people who have seen those images I was talking about, just incredible images. I mean, we heard right there in the headline about the firenados of the, you know, that are so hot, the wind whipping it up, that these fires actually look like they're spinning around like a tornado. Give us a sense of what it actually is like on the ground.
There's a lot of adrenaline going while you're there. It's pretty neat and awe-inspiring, I guess. Mm-hmm. So while you're there.
But I mean, what does it look like? What does it feel like? And just, you know, a sense of what it's like all around.
So when you're up close to it and you're feeling it, so the wind's changing and you know, it's definitely hot while you're out there, and the images that they show are pretty accurate representation of what it's actually like when you're there on the ground. But to be honest, those big images of the large flames and that, we try to stay pretty far away from those. You know, you just can't deal with them as a hand crew, which is typically what we go out with. So that sort of stuff's kind of dealt with heavy equipment and aircraft and that sort of stuff. So,
do you feel danger?
Speaking for myself, I try to put myself into a situation where I don't feel that danger. But everybody's a little bit different and their situational awareness is a little bit different. So I would like to think that the crews that go out with us don't feel that either. But, yeah, there are times where you might get in a situation where it's like, maybe you're a little bit unsure, and you just back up to a safety zone, escape route, whatever it might be.
There are our safety zones.
Yes, yeah. We make sure there's a lot of steps that we take before we engage on a fire to make sure that we have a way out, you know, if the need would arise to get out of there.
And so, all that comes with training, I imagine.
Yes, several thousand hours of training and experience too, you know.
So, Mike Kern, let's talk a little bit about that training. And first of all, the broad question of how Pennsylvania firefighters are involved in fighting these fires in the West.
Yeah, firefighting in the United States is really a national effort anymore. Most agencies don't have the resources on staff 24/7 to deal with anything that could happen. So we have a network of agreements and interagency cooperation where we can assist each other as needed. You know, whether we need to send people to another state or help a federal agency or a national park even, you know, we have those agreements in place. So it's really a national network where we exchange resources as needed.
And you are under Pennsylvania DCNR, Department of Conservation Natural Resources, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, is your job to fight fires mostly here in Pennsylvania, or is it kind of a national thing that because it seems as though every summer, and it seems as though for the last few summers, this is happening more and more where there are wildfires in the western part of the country?
Yeah, our main function within DCNR is we have responsibility for wildfire suppression in Pennsylvania statewide. So that's our main function, but our fire season here is mainly in the spring and sometimes in the fall. So in the summer is when it's wildfire season in the West. So we have firefighters who we're able to send to help other people where they're needed.
When you say it's mostly in the spring rather than the summer, I mean, we just 2 weeks ago, before we had the monsoons of last week, we had a 10-day period or so where no rain, it was very dry. So that's not prime season for forest fires here in Pennsylvania?
Not really. If you think about our weather in the spring, there's a period when the snow melts and it warms up, but the vegetation's still brown and dormant. And it's that period where we have most of our wildfires. Once things green up in Pennsylvania, and the grass is green and the trees get leaves on, they really can't burn because of the moisture that's in the vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
Unless if we get into severe drought in the summer, which we haven't had in a few years now in the summer here in Pennsylvania, then we could start to get summer fires. But that's not the normal here. Normal weather in Pennsylvania is hazy, hot, humid, and chance of thunderstorms. So you know, that's not really conducive to wildfires.
Yeah, and what we've, again, all last week and right now, we're in a period where there's a lot of rain. So I imagine that the risk of forest fires are low.
Yes.
We've all seen those Smokey Bear signs that talk about the risk of forest fires. So right now, would it be low throughout the state?
Yeah, I'd say today fire danger is fairly low.
How much of an issue are wildfires in Pennsylvania?
We do actually. We average about 500 to 600 wildfires a year that our personnel take action on that burn around 4,000 acres. So wildfires are an issue in Pennsylvania. They can be a big issue locally in certain places, but we don't tend to see the large landscape scale fires on the order of 100,000 acres like you see out west. Our biggest fire in the past 30 years is 8,000 acres, that's a big fire. And, you know, it can put people in danger, but it's not on the order of magnitude that the other states are dealing with.
You know, one of the things that has happened with the fires in the western part of the United States is that they are just so out of control, not all of them, but a lot of them, that structures are in danger. Has that happened here in Pennsylvania where people live actually have been in danger?
Yeah, actually, it happens more than folks realize. Most of our fires are started by people here, so they tend to be started near somebody's residence. And then, you know, that with the amount of people that live in the East and in Pennsylvania, you know, if a fire starts at somebody's house, there's a chance that it could endanger your garage or your neighbor's house or anything. So oftentimes we have fires that are maybe a quarter acre or an acre that don't even leave somebody's yard, but they burn their house or their garage down.
So. Actually, what is a wildfire?
So we call a wildfire anything that burns in wild, unseeded, or uncultivated land. So, you know, if it's not paved and it's not a farm field and it's not a yard, then basically we look at it as a wildfire.
Mm. By the way, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you know, Chad has been on the ground and witnessed some of these. Mike, have you?
I have, but it's been about 5 or 6 years.
Don't change.
No.
Just maybe get bigger in the West. But, you know, you can ask about their experiences as well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, and seeing those images, and most of us have seen those images on television, and again, they are just incredible. But Chad, you mentioned aircraft. When I see a helicopter or a plane flying with is it referred to as flame retardant? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Typically retardant.
Okay. How does that work? Because it just seems as though compared to the size of the fires, that would not make a dent in any of those fires.
How the retardant actually works is, it breaks up the chemical reaction that is needed to make fire. So they typically put it out ahead of where the fire is moving into. And then whenever the fire hits that vegetation, that retardant inhibits the ability for it to actually create and make fire. So it just kind of knocks it out at that point.
Does it work?
Oh, yeah, absolutely it works. So we were in Nevada this year. And so it's a real light, flashy fuel type. And so there's not really any trees necessarily. It's more like a shrub sage component. And that retardant works really well in that type of fuel model because it essentially lays right on the ground, fire burns right up to it, and typically goes out.
Let's talk about some of the ways that fires are fought. You know, we've seen the aircraft that have dropped the flame retardant. But also, I see a lot of firefighters with picks, shovels, doing a lot of digging. I got to say, it is hard work from just what it looks like.
Yes, it is. So it's not necessarily picks, but close, you know, Pulaski's, and we got some specialized tools that we use. But, you know, outside of aircraft, which knocks the ability for the fire to create heat or whatever, the other way to knock out fire is essentially remove the fuel. And that's where the ground pounders, you know, your hand crews and your heavy equipment come in. They bring dozers in, punch some line in, or we go out and just dig it. So
yeah, basically you're trying to remove the fuel, so you don't you're not necessarily putting the flames out, you're just taking the things away that burn, so the fire will burn up, and when it hits the bare dirt, usually is what you're doing is digging down to bare dirt, it stops burning because there's nothing left to burn. So a lot of times that's just some really hard work by people with hand tools and shovels and out there digging, and it's almost like digging you're a professional ditch digger on some level.
Is the ground easy to dig? I mean, I imagine there are some rocky areas, but because it's that dry, is it easier to dig?
Actually, out west is probably easier line digging than around here. This is probably some of the worst terrain. Pennsylvania has some of the worst terrain to dig line in because it's just rocks. At least out there, you got some sandy soils, and it's a little bit easier.
Also, we have seen where firefighters have started other fires. Ahead of where, I assume, where you think the fire is going to burn to where the wildfire is going to be. And I assume the reason for that is you burn some of the vegetation, some of what's fueling that fire. Does the fire stop when it gets there?
Yeah, the thought process with that is, so you dig your line in, and maybe it's not wide enough as you need it to be, so you want to go ahead and burn that vegetation out in between your line and where the flaming front's coming. And essentially, it just strengthens and reinforces the line that you dug. Mm-hmm.
So we have an email here from Paul, by the way. Let me do this first. Said you just said that no state has every piece of equipment needed for every fire that comes up. Why doesn't the entire U.S. send equipment to these wildfires and snuff them out within a day or so by just overwhelming the fire by numbers alone?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, nobody can send every one of their firefighters because we would still have to keep some people here in case we have issues. The same with a lot of the other states. You know, everybody has firefighters. They want to deal with their area. So we try to share. We can't share everything. The second reason, you know, what Chad said, you just can't put people too close to those flames. If you look at some of these really intense fires, to put people in there, you basically would be killing them. So there's just some of these fires are just, they're not that easy to deal with. Even with aircraft, you know, when you have 100,000 acres burning, I don't care how many aircraft you have, you're not going to be able to just extinguish the fire.
But I think the point that Paul makes is when the fire first starts, before it gets to 100,000 acres, why not put as many people there as you can, as much equipment as you can, and overwhelm it before it gets too big?
That sounds really, really good in theory, but you got to figure in the western part of the United States, there's a lot of wilderness out there that they might have a fire start and somebody might not see it for a day or two. So it's already had a chance to get much, much larger than you would like to start dealing with it. So
one of the things that's very noticeable when we see these images is the wind. I mean, even when I see people being interviewed or reporters standing there, that has been a part of the conditions that has created a problem this year, that it's very windy. And, you know, even what you described, Chad, as, you know, digging ditches, digging, pulling down the fuel, you know, starting other fires to keep it from spreading, the wind has, you know, it always amazes me when I see that the fire went across a road or went across a stream, went across a river, and that's fueled by the wind. Very windy out there this year, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say that's kind of a usual condition that we deal with. And like I said before, we got some parameters set up to deal with all that stuff. So one thing that firefighters do a lot of is we take weather all the time. That's typically what drives the fire. So we're constantly out checking weather, making sure that it's in line with what we're predicting it to do. And a lot of times we'll set up some management action points that if it drops to a certain percentage in our age, or that we get a wind shift of this, that, or the other, then we're backing off and going to reevaluate where we're at with the fire.
You know, people talk often about the difference in hot weather here in the East, in the Northeast, compared to, say, Arizona, California, other places in the West, that you often hear, well, it's a dry heat. It's you don't have the humidity out there. That's actually a problem when you're trying to fight a fire, that there is a lack of humidity, that the humidity is so low that the dry air helps to spawn that fire even farther.
Yes, the dry air actually pulls the moisture out of the fuels, which makes them drier, and in turn makes them more susceptible to burn. And Yeah, it's actually an issue.
We have another listener email. It says, how much do the firefighters in the West get paid, and how do they get to be that kind of firefighter? I took an ICS 300 course, and they said that many Native American families depend on the income from their young men working as firefighters during the wildfire season. A couple questions there.
Yeah, the basic firefighter, the federal standard rate is $18 an hour approximately to start. So, you know, there's some basic training you'd have to take. It's about 40 hours of basic training. You have to pass a fitness test. And then annually, you'd have to do some refresher training. That's about 8 hours. So that's how you get into it. You know, we offer the training here in the state. A lot of the federal agencies, all their employees get the training. State agencies, their employees that are firefighters get the training.
So when Chad and other firefighters have gone west, who pays them?
Well, we would pay them, and then we get reimbursed from whoever has jurisdiction for where the wildfire is occurring. So
this is very expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a multi-million-dollar process every year for all these wildfires to suppress them. It gets very expensive. The aircraft are very expensive, and your personnel. You know, you can have thousands of personnel in a large wildfire. So,
by the
it
way,
adds up.
Before I get any further, the listeners, ICS 300 course. What's that?
ICS is Incident Command System, and that's the national standard way that emergencies are dealt with, whether it's a fire or a flood or a hurricane response. You know, that's all from FEMA and Homeland Security, and it's just a common operating system where everybody has a certain job to do, and that's how emergencies are handled.
When you were talking about the aircraft being expensive, I understand that there have been occasions where, well, and maybe it's even part of it, that strategy has to be used as to when to use the aircraft, the flame retardants, and when not to, because it is so expensive, right?
I mean, that's a reality of, you know, any thing, government operation. You know, we have a budget, not to say that we're not going to take the steps necessary just because of the cost, but it does factor into it. You know, usually if you're a government, you're using people's tax dollars. So you want to use them effectively. You want to use aircraft when they're needed, and you want to, you know, try to do things as efficiently as you can when they're not needed.
And I think something that more falls in line, maybe it's not that you're holding back aircraft, but maybe it's use the right aircraft for the job. So if a heavy air tanker is available in a Type 2, and the Type 2 will do the job, don't order the most expensive thing to do the job when something smaller would do the job. And I think that's where cost savings comes into play more so than just holding back equipment, because you don't see that a ton.
Mike, any idea what it cost for like a run of a plane dropping flame retardant?
So we actually use aircraft here in the state. We use smaller aircraft, obviously. And those aircraft, I know we spend, it's about $1,800 an hour for flight time. So, you know, the bigger aircraft are orders of magnitude higher sometimes. helicopters actually seem to cost quite a bit of money too. They're more expensive to fly and maintain. So, you know, that cost gets passed on to the end user. So, you know, I think a large helicopter can be $8,000 to $10,000 an hour.
Wow. And I again, when you're talking about that, wonder whether the propellers on a helicopter actually flame some of the, you know, the fire. I mean, providing some air, does it actually happen that way?
Yeah, especially if they're doing like sling loads or something into an area that they happen to be hovering over some black, you'll get rotor wash. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're actually flaming fire itself, but you will see some embers and stuff pick up if you're in the black or
rotor
in the vicinity.
Wash, huh?
Yeah.
So I learned something today, rotor wash. Stephen asked, since so much of California is near an ocean, is it possible to use seawater to fight fires? And I'll follow up with that and ask, is water, access to water, an issue?
So I'll handle the water stuff. Yeah, water would be great. Unfortunately, it's not always available. So most of the time, we just do a lot of dry mop up in that, which is basically you take dirt, mix it up with the stuff that's hot and kind of deal with it like that. So water's kind of a commodity.
Yeah, when you said water's great, it was just kind of...
Yeah, it's great, but unfortunately we don't always have it. So, yeah, it's a lot of hard work to get it out without it. So.
Mike, what are you going to say?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, California is next to an ocean, but it's also a really big state if you start to drive around it, so...
Well, it's not just California. Yeah. Now, California's getting a lot of attention because the car fire is so big. But Oregon, Washington, all those West Coast states, Idaho, Nevada, so many, well, 15 states, as I said, fire's burning right now. Listener emails, the problem with sending lots of equipment to fires is that you need a place to put the equipment and a way to get the equipment in and out. Also, you have to pay for the use of the equipment and pay to feed and house the people operating the equipment. So, you know, he makes the point that
Correct.
This is a big job.
Yeah.
This is a big job.
Yeah, on these large fires, there can be, you know, thousands of people there and thousands of engines, and it's a huge logistical effort.
Mike Kern is Pennsylvania's chief forest fire warden. Chad Northcraft is a forester in Hazleton. He just returned from fighting fires in Nevada. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have two parts tomorrow, but one of the things we're going to talk about is civics education in Pennsylvania. There's a proposal to require testing of civics.